Early on in his nearly 40-year career as a journalist, Otto Friedrich learned how to cover a war without getting near the country it was being fought in. Friedrich was working for an American wire service and was based in Paris in 1953 when he filed stories about the French war in Indochina. In 1959, he wrote an article called How to Be a War Correspondent, and he says the article was motivated by his sense of guilt. The article is included in his new collection of essays, The Grave of Alice B. Toklas and Other Reports from the Past. Friedrich is also the author of City of Nets, a book about Hollywood in the 1940s, and a biography of Canadian pianist Glenn Gould. Since 1971, Friedrich has written for Time magazine. I asked him to describe the reporting he now feels so guilty about, covering Vietnam from France.
The French army periodically issued bulletins on what was going on in Vietnam, and these were officially announced. So that was the major source of information, whether they were announced in Paris or in Vietnam. And the cheapest way to get this information was to have the Paris Bureau report it. And, of course, we dressed it up a bit by, you know, made it more exciting.
Like how?
Well, you know, the French army communiqués were sort of uninformative, and it's not just uninformative; they were bland. And the AP would always say, you know, the French army announced today that we would say, combat infantry men of such and such a regiment in battle, full battle dress, splashed ashore today, and three-way landings, that sort of thing. And this is what got printed.
Yeah. Well, you say that your editors always wanted you to write with enthusiasm.
Yeah. Well, that was the term for that kind of writing.
Mm-hmm. Action verbs.
Yeah. and generally a sense of excitement, just as though you were there when, of course, you weren't there.
Mm-hmm. You also say that there was a pressure to write almost fiction from two ends, pressure from the military, but also pressure from your editors. Would you explain that pressure on both ends to kind of dress up and almost fictionalize the stories you were writing?
Well, you have to remember that by pressure from the government, I mean the French government was constantly looking to America for financing for its war, and so they wanted to convey the impression that they were doing big things in Indochina, and they just needed a little more help all the time. When I say editors, remember that I don't mean my own editors so much as the editors of newspapers who just get this stuff coming in. They don't know where it's coming from, and they just, you know, pick the most exciting story. So if your story is consistently the more exciting one, that's what's going to get printed.
Mm-hmm. Was there ever any pressure for political slant from your editors?
No. Quite the opposite. they didn't want any politics. This was purely a war story. It was a French war story, so we didn't really care what it was all about. It was just, you know, it was a shoot 'em up kind of story. Nobody had paid any attention to Vietnam while the Korean War was going on. And after the Korean War ended, editors sort of felt a nostalgia for the good old daily war story. So all of a sudden they became more interested in Vietnam. And it was, as I say, it was purely a shoot 'em up war, as it was in the early days of the American involvement. You know, the Americans would announce how many casualties they'd inflicted today, and that was the story, at least if the American government had had its way.
You're making it sound like very, very phony news coverage. How did you live with it if you felt that it was so deceitful?
Well, it is phony. You live with it because that's what you did for a living. They would tell you, you know, you're working here and you're writing stories not only about that, but about everything that happens in Paris and in the whole French Union, for that matter. The French then control much of the world. And here we were, one guy next to an AFP ticker is responsible for converting what comes in on the AFP ticker. That's Agence France-Presse, the French national news agency. We're in effect a glorified translation of that and jazzing it up to make it sound like an American story.
Mm-hmm.
And this is not, it doesn't pose that much of a crisis of conscience, you know, if you're, at least in the old days, you did what you were told because you had to. That's how you got a job and that's how you kept a job.
From 1957 to 1962, you left Newsweek, and then a couple of years after you left in 1964, you wrote an article for Harper's Magazine about how for Newsweek you had to file stories, that reporters always seem to file stories with a lot of pretty pointless facts, and that there was a corresponding editorial fetish for accuracy in absurd facts. What's an example of a pointless fact?
Well, they're not pointless. Pieces? They're not pointless. They have a very definite point. The definite point is to convey an impression that the writer or reporter in this story is absolutely the supreme authority on every aspect of that story, that he knows whatever it is, the color of the man's eyes, how old he is, what he wears, what kind of underwear he wears, what he eats for breakfast. All that kind of essential trivia is put in to convey this impression of absolute authoritativeness. And that, as I say, that implies that any political judgments that are being made are equally authoritative. We really know what we're talking about.
We found that, you know, it's very common for reporters to not really know the specifics of the fact they were using. The example you use in your title is that there are 00 trees in Russia, and it would be the fact-checker's job to find out exactly how many trees are in Russia. And the reporter would just leave it blank. What was that practice called?
I don't think it had a name, actually.
Oh, okay.
But let me clarify something. It was not the reporters who did this. It was the writers and editors. The essential, and I should also explain, this has changed somewhat to give more authority to the reporters now than they had then. The essential system then was that the reporter filed everything he knew to New York, where a writer took it and combined it with anything else he was found interesting, whether it was a clipping from the New York Times or some government report or some anything. All available sources were used, along with the reporter's report, to create the most interesting and authoritative article that you could. And often, if there was some fact that you wanted to illustrate some point, and you didn't know what the exact fact was, or it wasn't in the reporter's file, you just left a 00. It's a kind of fact that is wanted. The specific fact is left up to the fact checker.
What's wrong with that?
Well, in a sense, there's nothing wrong with it. except when you get these weird, when it's done wrong in some weird way. Like, my classic story is about the Sudanese army, which was told me by a fact checker, and she couldn't find out what the number of the editor had written in the 00 man Sudanese army, and she couldn't find the number, and she called the Sudanese embassy, and they couldn't tell her what it was. And finally, the editor told her to make an educated guess, which is what people did as you got nearer the deadline. So she said there was a 17,000-man Sudanese army, and this duly got printed, and then the Sudanese embassy would sort of make cull stories from the American press that dealt with Sudan. That would be sent back to Khartoum, and then the Khartoum press would say, print stories saying, here's what they are saying about us in America. And so they printed this story saying there was a 17,000-man Sudanese army. And then that duly went back to New York, to Washington, as an example of the sort of summary of the Khartoum press for this week. And this guy, same guy at the Sudanese embassy, called up this woman about, you know, a month later and said, oh, now I can finally tell you the number of men there are in the Sudanese army. Exactly 17,000. He was so pleased. And she thought it was, you know, this was the sort of parody of the whole system.
You've worked both at Time and at Newsweek. You've been at Newsweekly's a long time, so I think you'll be able to answer this question. What's the logic behind separating the two tasks of reporting and writing? For instance, frequently in the news magazines, you'll see that the article is written by one person, but it's reported by a different person.
Mm-hmm. Again, I should preface this by saying that there are many people who have that same problem, and the tendency now is to have more and more reporters write their own stories, or vice versa, have writers go out and report their own stories. I'm probably old-fashioned. I don't like this technique. I like the technique of separating them. The main reason why it's done is that it gives the writer an enormous flexibility about what to get from where. I mean, many stories, particularly in news magazine stories, involve material that comes from all kinds of places: Moscow, Washington, Beirut, whatever. If you want to do a story on the state of opera in America, you might want a file from New York and a file from Boston and a file from Houston. And you'd have all these different correspondents filing into you, you see, and you'd put it all together. If you have one reporter writing his own story, you either got to have a story only from one place, i.e. there's a murder in Denver, or you got to send him around from place to place, which takes months. Whereas the standard news magazine technique can put together a very complicated story. Let's say there's the change of government in Russia, and you might want a story from China. You want information from China, from Washington, wherever. You might also want a lot of history about past changes in Russia, which you could get best in New York from your library. And so it enables the news magazine editors, and that's the key thing about news magazines, is that they're heavily edited magazines. It enables the editor to put together a complicated story from a lot of different places in very fast time, which you just can't do by having the reporters do it themselves.
No, I always assumed that the real reason behind that separation of functions was to have a reporter who can write in the house style, so to speak, you know, who can write in that... in the style that Newsweek calls its own, or Time calls its own.
That used to be true to some extent, but it's changed to some extent in that news magazine copy isn't as different as it used to be from what appears in a newspaper or any other kind of media. But There's also a question of can a reporter write at all? You know, I mean, when I was at the Daily News, there were plenty of police reporters who'd never written a story in their lives. Their function was to know what was going on in the police station and on the police beat. They weren't supposed to know how to write, and they would telephone in whatever they had, and the rewrite man on the desk would take it down, and he would write the story. He's supposed to know how to write. I still think that's true to some extent. I mean, I think that you now now that you have more reporters writing their own stories, you have people who are wonderful reporters and not terrific writers having to write stories because that's the way it's done now, and they're often not as well written as they could be if a really good writer were doing it.
Mm-hmm.
Conversely, a lot of writers like me, I mean, I hate to do reporting, and I'm a very good writer. If you send me out to do reporting, you won't get as good reporting as you will from some guy who is really good at it.
What's kept you at News Weeklies for so long?
Well, it's fairly pleasant work. They pay very well, and I know how to do it well, so these things all tend to work to make the job rather pleasant.
Otto Friedrich, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.